like to call the Senate Committee on Human Services and Rural Health Policy to order. And the chair is detained, but he will be here soon. So I'd like to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 876. Jennifer?
Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 876 requires the Department of Human Services to pay for brand name rather than generic immunosuppressant drugs prescribed in connection with organ transplants.
Okay. Jim Edge and Rick Bennett.
Good morning, Chair Cruz and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jim Edge. I'm Assistant DHS Director with the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. I'm here this morning to testify in opposition to this bill. This bill would require the Oregon Health Plan to pay for brand name drugs in a class of drugs called immunosuppressants, even when generic drugs are available in this class. Immunosuppressants are drugs that are given to suppress the immune system when a patient has had an organ transplant. The Oregon Health Plan currently encourages the use of generic drugs when they're available and when they're equivalent to a brand name drugs, and we achieve considerable savings in that way. Generally, when a patent expires on a brand name drug and generic drug equivalent drugs become available, there is considerable savings, sometimes as much as 90% over the cost of the brand name prior to the patent expiration. And we try as much as we can to provide as much health care as available as we can for as many patients as we can, and this is one of the ways we try to do that. In this class of drugs, there are brand name drugs which have generics available, and there are brand name drugs which don't have generics available. And we do encourage the use of the generic drugs when they're available. I understand this particular bill is primarily about a brand name drug which is called Prograf, which currently does not have a generic available. But I think the desire of the sponsor of the bill is to protect the brand name drug if and when a generic ever does become available. We would be opposed to that. We feel that there is protection that could be placed, it could be in place if there was any concern about the generic not being equivalent to the brand name. I understand the manufacturer has actually submitted information to the Federal Food and Drug Administration to consider the fact that this drug may be a drug that has what's called a narrow therapeutic index, which means that the difference between the therapeutic level of the drug and a toxic level of the drug is narrow. And the Food and Drug Administration has not yet ruled on that submission by the manufacturer. But if and when they do, if they determine that there is a narrow therapeutic index, then there will be much more scrutiny about the allowance of any generic drug, and there will be much more care taken to make sure that any generic drug that becomes available would truly be equivalent to the brand name drug. We also have protections within the state. We have a drug use review board, which also would look, if generics became available to this drug, would look at the scientific literature and make a determination about whether the brand name drug is truly equivalent to the generic drugs, and we could make exceptions if we felt that there really was a narrow therapeutic index and a generic should not be allowed. But in general, we feel that the use of generic drugs is a good thing. The cost of generic drugs is generally results in considerable savings to the agency. We feel allowing an entire class of drugs like this to be protected and for the department not to be allowed to encourage the use of generic drugs is would set a bad precedent that there might be further classes of drugs that then would be proposed to be protected from generic equivalents, and we feel that that would be a slippery slope that we wouldn't want to go down. We want to encourage the use of generics and the savings that occur from them. There is a fiscal associated with this because there are drugs in this class already that have generics that achieve savings for us. And the fiscal is not large because it's not a large class of drugs. It's about $357,000 total funds for the next biennium if this bill were to pass. So, with that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Let's do the panel first, then. So go ahead, Rick.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Rick Bennett, Director of Government Relations for AARP. I've provided written testimony to you. I won't read that. Let me just hit a couple of bullets, and if there are any questions, we can do so. AARP must oppose Senate Bill 876 for some of the reasons that Mr. Edge has already indicated. The use of generic drugs is among the most successful ways to hold down overall cost of prescription drugs. And as indicated, the Federal Food and Drug Administration has a rigorous process for approving generic drugs, including narrow therapeutic index drugs, as we're speaking to today. It's interesting that as many drugs face generic competition for the first time, we're seeing an increased effort around the country to undermine generic substitution laws. AARP does a quarterly newsletter related to called the RX Watchdog Report, and February's edition was entirely devoted to this issue of efforts to curb the use of generic drugs. It's making it harder to dispense generic drugs impacts all of us who pay for health care, individuals, employers, and as Mr. Edge just indicated, taxpayers as well. I think it should be noted that doctors already have, as they should, the authority to require that their patients be dispensed a brand name drug. There's no need for legislation of this type. Studies by the FDA, the American Medical Association, and Harvard researchers in a paper published recently in the Journal of American Medical Association have all supported that position. Thank you.
Mr. Edge, under current law, if a physician wants the brand drug and he writes no substitution on the prescription, what happens?
Chair Cruz, under current law, a physician can write no substitution, and then that brand name will be dispensed.
Is there any additional paperwork that has to go with it, or is that it?
Chair Cruz, if a generic is available, and if the Oregon Health Plan has determined that the generic is equivalent and implemented what's called a maximum allowable cost. What we pay for is the cost of a generic drug, and a brand name can be dispensed, but the payment from the Oregon Health Plan would be the maximum allowable cost based on the generic drug. So there can be a prior authorization achieved in that case. The physician's office could call and say that there is a reason why they would like the brand name dispensed, and in that case, that could be done.
Okay, thank you. Senator Mona Sanderson?
Thank you. If a patient had a reaction and the doctor had put, don't substitute, but has a reaction, tell us the process.
Chair Cruz, Senator Mona Sanderson, absolutely. In that case, the brand name would be dispensed. It would occur through a phone call for a prior authorization, and then the brand name would be dispensed.
Just follow up. And a phone call, is there always someone on the other end to answer that phone?
Chair Cruz, Senator Mona Sanderson, yes, there always is. We use a pharmacy benefit administrator that always answers their phone.
Okay.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Follow up on Senator Mona Sanderson's question. If there is a reaction, and we've had, let's say, $1 million liver transplant, can that reaction be terminal? I mean, could that cause somebody's death?
Chair Cruz, Senator Telfer. Theoretically, I'm sure that there can be a reaction of any kind to anything, but normally the process of establishing a generic drug requires an extensive scientific development and proof of equivalence that occurs both at the federal level with the Food and Drug Administration and then is reviewed again at the state level. So by the time a generic drug is available and would be considered a substitute for a brand name drug, there's been extensive scientific research and equivalency has been established. The rare instance of maybe a dye in the drug or something like that that might cause a reaction could possibly go either direction. It could be that the brand name drug might cause a reaction that the generic didn't cause, or the generic might cause a reaction that the brand name didn't cause. But the medical equivalency, the bioequivalency of the drug has been established by that point.
Okay. Other questions, comments? Okay, thank you. Others wishing to testify? Okay, seeing no one, we will close the public hearing. Questions?
Well, we are carrying this over.
Yeah, we're going to carry it over. Yeah.
We don't have the Fizz Riz yet.
Yeah, okay. Well, we're
going to
close the public hearing
on Wednesday, right?
Carry it over. Until Wednesday, okay? We'll open Senate Bill 937 and...
Mr. Chair, you aren't gone long enough for me to actually pass anything. I'm really disturbed.
Senator Virgin. Oh, you were waiting for an invitation. Good morning, Senator Virgin.
Good morning, Chair Marcet. It's nice that you are here today. Chair Marcet, members of the committee, I'm Joanne Berger, representing Senate District 5. Today I'm a sponsor of Senate Bill 937. The current lax requirements for permits for disabled parking has caused a great disservice to our disabled community. The lack of proper regulation of the program has resulted in a shortage, for one thing, of places to park for them, and it also is a loss of revenue for local governments. Currently, because of the lack of regulation, these permits do not expire. So what you have to do is you have to bring in order to get a permit, you get a medical professional to give you a certificate that says that you are disabled and you are eligible to park in these places. What happens, though, is that that permit does not expire. So when you, there's dated on it, but when that expires, you just go back and state that you have a right to continue to park in those areas because you are disabled. No requirement from a medical profession. So that's the change that this law makes. It says that in order to renew that permit, you're going to have to bring a certificate from a medical profession. The abuse of this is caused by several different things. One, permits are sold. They are lost or stolen. Permits that belong to a deceased relative are used, and permits that are borrowed. And so it's really a simple change, just in order, if you are in need of a disabled parking permit, I'm sure that a medical professional will not have any problem in helping you get that renewed. However, to be able to keep these permits and use them for 5 years is not acceptable. So this will greatly reduce the abuse, and I encourage you to listen as others are going to testify about this particular bill. So I'm going to return to the dais, Chair Marcet, and then after everyone has testified, I would like to move the dash ones to the bill. There's no fiscal statement, though, on the dash ones, so you will not be able to move the bill if you should so desire today, but I would like that opportunity to move it into the bill.
Thank you. David Broomberg, and Nolan Merkel, and Betty Rizlon. Welcome, David.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm David Barenberg, and I'm a lobbyist for the City of Portland. And with me today is Nolan LaCrille and Betsy Rizlon. Nolan is the parking enforcement manager for the City of Portland, and Betsy is a from Elders in Action and was a member of a task force we had in Portland looking at this issue. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thank you, Senator Verger, for bringing forward the bill, and Senator Telfer and Senator Anderson for being co-sponsors of this legislation. This legislation is a step in trying to address some of the concerns raised by Senator Verger that the existing system that we have is rather lax in the renewal of disabled parking permits, of which just in Multnomah County there are 33,000. And we just want to ensure that those who truly deserve the permits have them, and that they have the opportunity to find spaces to park when they need them as they go about their tasks of daily living. And with that, I would like to, with the Chair's permission, pass the microphone on to Nolan.
Good morning. Chair Morissette, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to appear before you today regarding Senate Bill 937, addressing the disabled parking permit renewal. For the record, I'm Nolan McCrill, Parking Enforcement Division Manager of the City of Portland, Bureau of Transportation. I would like to thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak before your committee on the renewal of disabled parking permit placards. Today I will describe the problem we are trying to solve, how the bill will address the problem, the benefits that will result, and some of the amendments to fine-tune this bill. The bill addresses a glitch in the process for renewing disabled parking permits that contribute to the problem that has caused a great disservice to the disabled community. The fact that the permits fall into the hands of people who are not disabled, plus the fact that the permits are renewed without any certification by a health professional of a continuing disability, both undermine the purpose and integrity of the program and disadvantages those who need the access to parking within a short distance of their destination. Failure to ensure that only those that qualify will be able to renew a permit results in a shortage of available parking spaces. Pressure to restrict the privilege, lost revenue for local governments, and the diminished credibility for truly disabled and for the state. Fraudulent use could result from any several circumstances. The person is no longer disabled, but the permit is still valid because permits are issued for either 6 months for a temporary permit or 8 years at a time. The permit was obtained fraudulently. The permit was legally issued to someone else and is being used improperly because it was sold, sometimes even on eBay or garage sales, lost or stolen, belongs to a deceased relative or friend, has been borrowed, or for some other reason. Currently, permits are renewed based solely on the statement by the permit holder that they are still qualified to hold the permit. The bill would change this by requiring that the permit holder provide a certificate to their doctor stating that they continue to qualify for the permit as required by state law. This is the same process the permit holder had to complete when the permit was initially issued. This bill requires the permit holder to have their disability recertified by a qualified medical provider prior to renewal. While this does require a doctor visit, we believe that many disabled persons are more likely to visit their doctor regularly. Strengthening the renewal process for a disabled placard has several benefits, including increasing opportunities for using disabled parking privileges, provides updated database of placard holders, mitigates potential abuse, only those truly disabled could use the placard, reduces fraud and disrespect for the law, minimizes doubts about the legitimacy of a permit holder's disability. This bill could produce less reissuance of placards and could increase available parking spaces for all parkers. This Dash 1 amendment seeks to fine-tune the bill by requiring that the medical provider's certification of disability not be older than 6 months and requiring that the medical provider include their license number along with their signature. Future improvements to this program could include creating a process for verification of applications for signature of a licensed medical provider and creating a database for licensed medical providers signing applications to monitor excessive abuse. In conclusion, the City of Portland supports Senate Bill 937 because it reduces disabled placard abuse, creates a more credible system, increases parking availability, and respects the privilege granted to this important community. Thank you for this opportunity to address this issue, and I urge your support, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
maybe I missed something, but how do we make the transition if this bill passes?
Well, if the bill passes, Chair Morrison, if the bill passes in January, if the bill passed when it became law, then the new when your driver's license expires, so does your disabled placard. And so when you renew your driver's license, you would renew your placard at the same time, and then you would be required then to bring in a new certification from your physician, medical provider to get a new disabled placard.
So there could be some placards out there as long as 7 or 8 years.
Senator Chair Morris, yes, that's true. Until the renewal is until your driver's license expires, but in the transition, this would reduce it slowly over time.
Okay, what's to prevent a person who gets a new driver's license from continuing to use the placard? Will there be a different kind of placard then?
Chair Morris, the placard has an expiration date on it. So when
visible from the outside.
Yes, that's correct. And so
in big red letters.
I believe it's in blue. They're in black letters.
Well, put them on red letters on black background. Yellow.
No.
Okay. Mr. Chair, we did consider the idea of doing a earlier renewal requirement to get in an earlier cycle so we could clean out some of the permits that were out there and not being used correctly. The only problem with that was that it would create a fiscal for DMV to have to do more work. So that's a quicker way of getting at it, and this was the method we thought we could avoid a trip to Ways and Means with.
Okay. Yes. Okay. Senator Monta Sanders.
So every 6 months you would need to get a prescription.
Chair Morissette, Senator Mon Sanderson, only on the temporary placard. If you
on
have
the temporary
a disability, you would get a 6 month placard, and the DMV will now also offer an additional temporary for another 6 months. And one of the problems that we have with this is if you had a temporary disability that lasted more than 6 months, but maybe 7 or 8 months, the next placard you would have received would have been a permanent placard that you would have had forever.
Okay.
Are there expiration dates on it now? Is there anything on it to indicate that?
Chair Morris, yes, there are right now. There are expiration dates on all the disabled placards that are issued from Oregon.
Based on
your
driver's license. But then when you, under the existing law, you don't have to have permission. You just renew your license and continue to use. Is the placard updated then?
Chair Morissette, the placard is updated when you renew your driver's license, and DMV would update any additional information.
Well, wait a
minute. Placard.
Right now, it is updated when you renew your license.
That's correct, Chair Morissette.
Okay. Other questions? Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Senator Morissette, and members of the committee for allowing me to testify today. I am Betty Brislon. I was on the Portland Task Force looking at this issue, representing Elders in Action. In 1998, I was diagnosed with COPD, which is chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and I have only 25% of my lung capacity left. I'm very active in the community, and the only way I could do this is with a handicap tag. In the beginning, I didn't ask for one. The doctor offered it, and I said no, because I wanted to force myself to walk more. But as I, particularly one day here, walking about 7 blocks, I think 3 times during the day, I decided to leave early and go to my doctor. I asked for the office secretary to provide the certificate. He signed it, and I went to the DMV, and the next day I came back here and parked in front. So I've also been very active in the effort to prevent some of the destructive ballot measures that have been put forth since 2000. And I am all over the community, and without this handicap tag, I couldn't do that. One of the things that I regret looking at the way the bill is written today is that my favorite Burgerville restaurant on MLK only has one parking spot for handicapped, and it's marked for wheelchair only. So I would probably get there somehow, but it would be difficult. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Others, okay, thanks. Others wishing to testify? Okay. We'll...
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
We'll
close the public hearing and open a work session to move the dash ones.
All right. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash ones to Senate Bill 937.
Okay. Senator Bridger moves the dash ones to Senate Bill 957.
937.
Discussion? Okay. No dissent. So moved. Okay, we will. Now we need a.
We're still waiting.
Yeah, we're waiting for it. Okay. Okay, so we'll close the work session and come back to that hopefully on Wednesday. Hopefully. Okay. Okay, Senate Bill 845 will be carried over until Wednesday. Senator Bates will be testifying on this bill, and he is not here today, so we will open a work session. A little premature for a work session. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 858, and Senator Montes Anderson will testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Senator Lori Montes Anderson, and I represent Gresham, Troutdale-Wood Village in Fairview. I serve on the Governor's Task Force on Drug and Alcohol Prevention, as well as we have an interim work group or task force on underage drinking.
You're good.
And there were a number of stakeholders, and we spent a year because we truly wanted to implement something this session, but the economy changed all that. So I debated on whether to introduce this bill or not because it does have a fiscal, but I felt we needed to have the conversation. When we had a media campaign for cigarette smoking, underage cigarette smoking, I guess you could call it, it was extremely effective. And the data showed that the smoking actually decreased when we really did an all-out good media campaign focused on adolescents. I think it's important for you to know that right now we have over 306,000 youth between the ages of 12 to 17, and 19,000 of those need treatment for alcohol use. That's almost
10%. 17,000 need treatment for illicit drug use. So we do have a problem in the state of Oregon, and it is getting worse. The use of alcohol increased for eighth graders from 24.8% in 2001 to 31.9% in 2006. Now, we did have a decrease in eighth graders for other drugs, but not for alcohol. We had a substantial increase in 2007 of the use of alcohol for 11th graders, and it's now up to 48.7%. This is unacceptable, and we can't put our head in the sand and say it's not happening, because it is. Prom season is coming up, and alcohol is going to flow, and car crashes are actually the number one cause of death for teenagers. So, colleagues, that's why I brought this forward to you, and I think there are other people who would like to testify on this bill. I would definitely would love to send it to Ways and Means, but realize that due to the problems with the economy, that there certainly isn't going to be funding. But who knows, maybe some miracle would happen and we would have some money available through a grant or something. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay, Kathleen. Dee Berridge, come up, please. Stephanie?
Good morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. My name is Kayleen Dethridge, and I'm the Vice President of Oregon Partnership, a statewide nonprofit that provides alcohol and drug prevention and education, as well as treatment referral. Thank you very much for accepting public testimony this morning on Senate Bill 858. It's vital that Oregon fund comprehensive statewide community outreach and media campaigns to reduce underage drinking, the number one drug problem among our youth. And for the health and safety of our adolescents and teens, it's critical that we take this step now. I'd like to share a few statistics that underscore the sobering truth about underage drinking in our state. About 30% of 8th graders and almost half of 11th graders consumed alcohol in the past month. One in every four high school juniors binged on alcohol in the past 30 days, consuming more than five drinks in a row in one setting. Almost 30% of our high school juniors say that they first had more than a sip or two of alcohol when they were 12 years old or younger. And today, nationwide, Oregon youth drink at a rate about 94% above the national average. So we have a big problem in our state with respect to underage alcohol use. At the same time, the public, by and large, is aware of both the scope of the problem and its consequences. Youth drinking today isn't what it was when we were growing up. Extreme drinking is all too common. Young girls in Oregon now drink at higher rates than young boys, a disturbing trend that we've never seen before in our state. Among parents, research has exposed a sharp disconnect when it comes to youth drinking. Parents who took part in focus groups just a few years ago said that they knew lots of kids drank, but most parents didn't think that their child drank, and they didn't plan to take any special steps towards preventing alcohol use unless they saw a problem with their own child. The reality is that youth drinking has dangerous safety and health consequences. Alcohol is a major contributor to teen death, injury, and violence. Compelling scientific research has found that regular drinking can harm a child's developing brain and make it difficult both to learn and to remember. People who start drinking before age 15 are four times more likely to become alcohol dependent at some point in their lives. The sheer financial impact of underage drinking is enormous. According to an International Institute for Alcohol Awareness report, underage drinking cost Oregon citizens $724 million in 2005. Those costs included medical care, work loss, and pain and suffering. Clearly, given the high rate of youth drinking and its consequences, the need for public awareness and behavior change, Oregon needs what it has never had, an adequately funded statewide campaign focused on preventing youth alcohol use. Research is clear that such campaigns are effective. Evidence of the effectiveness of media awareness campaigns lies in a separate campaign that Oregon Partnership helped spearhead at the request of the Governor's Meth Task Force. In 2004 and 2005, we managed a campaign that mobilized communities to address methamphetamine in Oregon. By educating the public about the devastating impacts of meth production, trafficking, use, and impacts that touched all of us, Oregon ultimately passed legislation that limited the key ingredient to manufacture meth, pseudoephedrine. The result? A near total elimination of meth labs in our state. So we know the public awareness campaigns work. I think with respect to Senate Bill 858, the central question is what kind of future do we want for our adolescents and teens? If the answer is a healthy and safe childhood free of alcohol, we simply must invest in the kind of campaigns that Senate Bill 858 calls for. Complemented by strategies such as better enforcement of underage drinking laws and swift and consistent penalties for minors who possess alcohol. Those strategies were outlined in the Oregon Attorney General's 2006 Underage Drinking Task Force report. And as that task force noted, its work was an important step in combating underage drinking, but a much broader effort is needed, one that changes norms and behaviors towards drinking in our state. Sustained, well-funded community outreach and media campaigns can accomplish that important goal. Our experience shows that those campaigns are most effective when they involve public and private sectors, allowing key messages to be seen and heard widely and consistently by the public, leading to the changes in norms and attitudes that make our kids safer. Oregon deserves nothing less. Thanks for the opportunity to address the committee this morning.
Thank you. Stephanie?
Chair Morissette and members of the committee, I'm Stephanie Suarez Pump, Chair of the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. I want to give public recognition to Senator Lori Moniz Anderson, not only for her leadership in underage drinking concerns, but for her courage, given our times, for bringing this bill forward. A year ago, the Governor and First Lady asked the Council to convene the statewide leadership team for alcohol-free kids. They did this out of recognition that we have an epidemic of underage drinking in Oregon. The team was chaired by Senator Lori Moniz Anderson. Members of the Attorney General's Underage Drinking Task Force were participants as well in order to coordinate the two initiatives. The Governor's charge asked the team to develop a comprehensive set of recommendations, and I've listed those here in the areas that he wanted us to explore. The team also utilized the Surgeon General's report on underage drinking when he issued his call for action, as this is a national problem, not just an Oregon problem. We've also used the Join Together Blueprint for States, which looked at how states could more effectively organize initiatives such as underage drinking. The bill before you today addresses two of the five action areas defined by the governor, that being strengthening community mobilization and leadership efforts and targeted and consistent statewide publication efforts. Underage drinking is one of the most serious health and social and economic problems we have in Oregon today. Nearly a third of eighth graders drink. That's about one in every eight kids in every classroom. These are 14-year-olds. My nephew is a good example. Kayleen mentioned this as well. My nephew was drinking by the time he was eight. By the time he was 14, he was a meth addict. This is something that happens to kids from all walks of life. Nearly 46% of 11th graders drink. That's almost half of the kids in every classroom. Binge drinking is on the rise. Girls are drinking more than boys. Both genders are drinking hard liquor. Given an adolescent brain isn't fully developed until the early to mid-20s, think of the harm being done by this behavior and the learning that is being impaired. If this were measles or chickenpox, everyone from the media to healthcare providers would be all over the problem. Why are we not equally alarmed with this health issue? Oregon students drink at a rate substantially higher than the national average. Sadder yet is the fact that underage drinking has steadily escalated since 2001, coinciding with the budget cuts of 2001-2002, when Oregon all but dismantled prevention. I've included a list of the services we've lost and the activities in your packets. I have also given each of you your county's underage drinking fact sheet. so that you can see what the rate is like close to home. We must begin to reinvest in prevention if we are ever going to impact underage drinking epidemic. This bill would be a significant start toward that end. We recognize there are serious economic considerations this session, but think of the economic repercussions of not acting to reduce this epidemic. Poor school performance, physical and emotional developmental problems, unintended pregnancies, traffic crashes, accidents and injuries, health care consequences. With all due respect, not acting is far more costly. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Have we made any progress in getting the sports drinks that contain alcohol and look just like non-alcoholic beverages out of the stores or marked or moved? Or
some. On the national level as well as here in Oregon, OLCC was on top of this problem early on, and that was a big help. It's still, do you want to add to that? There's still some areas of concern.
Yeah, a few of the products have been removed, and a few are still there. So it's better than it was a year ago, but there's still progress to be made.
Well, are they clearly marked? And that was part of the problem. They're lookalikes.
They are lookalikes.
And obviously, and I believe, intentional lookalikes.
Yeah.
So very, you have to look very closely to discriminate those that are containing alcohol and those that are not. And
yeah,
that some of those containing alcohol have been removed from the market, but there are still a few on the market, and that the lookalike continues to be an issue.
Okay, but OLCC is dragging its feet, right? Their collective feet. They should be removed, period. Or put into a alcohol area, and they're not.
Well, and that is something that we have been working with OLCC on. Sure, there's more that they can do, but they're understaffed as well, especially in the enforcement division, and they're facing losing half of their enforcement staff when really we ought to be doubling it.
Well, I know, but just with an administrative rule or an order by OLCC for drinks to be put into a particular area would suffice. I mean, it seems to me...
I'd be happy to take your opinion to the director.
If you would, please. No, really, I think that's ridiculous that they don't do that. They can just simply say that those drinks will be put in with the alcohol drinks and not mixed in with drinks that look...
That message will get conveyed today.
Thank you. Okay. And it would help if we raise the price 15 cents for 12 ounces.
That would help, too.
That would help, too.
And clearly, administratively, they can do that as well.
Oh. Okay. Gee. And then they could dedicate the 15 cents per drink. What do you mean administratively they can do that?
They have just increased the price of liquor to help offset the cost, the loss of revenue to the package store.
I don't know if they
operators
could do that with beer.
I guess maybe that's true.
Well, we'll have
but
to.
Then we're working on the beer.
We'll have to work
too,
on that issue. It would be easier if we just raised the price 15 cents instead of going through the agony of a beer tax.
It would.
We'll work on that. Okay. Take that message to the OLCC as well, please.
Okay,
Stephanie, thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
We should have had OLCC come.
Yes.
We yeah, missed the boat on that one.
We did miss the boat on that one.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yes, Senator
Bridger. Yes, I would like either or both of you to respond to just several things. One is in the prevention of alcohol in with teens. Are they is the explanation made to them that some people simply cannot drink, and that if they do drink, they may be one of those that would lead to alcoholism? That would be one thing, because I think that there's more and more evidence that some people can drink and never, it won't be a bother and they'll quit, but others that have that preponderance are going to be alcoholics if they drink. And the other thing is, do you think that the age limit for drinking forces a lot of teens to think in terms of doing something illegal? It has more of a magic to it because it now is illegal. Has there been any studies with states that allow people to drink legally at age 18 as opposed to those who allow people to drink legally at age 21?
Okay, these are two really big questions.
You take one, I'll take one.
Senator Morissette, Senator Verger, members of the committee. All states' drinking age is 21, and that has been true for about 22 years or so when federally we raised the drinking age and tied that public policy decision in states to the receipt of transportation funds in the states. Eventually, they all come along, and so we haven't had a drinking age that's been 18 anywhere in the country from...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, over two decades. To my knowledge, there is no... Part of the problem with your first question is there is nowhere in the state where the law is being enforced requiring K-12 education in the alcohol and drug area. Part of the cuts that have happened over the years is in the dismantling of prevention has happened in education as well as in human services. And there are some school districts which are still at least attempting to do some curriculum and some prevention work. And some school districts who work well with their community coalitions. But it's inconsistent statewide. And Coos County is a good example. I was a constituent for a couple of years and worked in the prevention area in Coos County. And there's very little education going on outside of the local community coalition. That's true in almost all of your counties. The primary work in Senator Cruz's county is done by a community coalition, but they're in partnership with the Roseburg School District at least, and there's a good public effort to educate there. In Clackamas County, not so much. Lane County, not so much. In Lane County, the coalition is very active. That's part of the beauty of this bill. This would resurrect the community coalition effort, given that we've not been able to impact the education effort.
That's good information. I like the idea of the partnership with the school districts. And
most of us do.
Well, maybe we can explore that possibility, too, in Lane
County.
Could
I have one quick follow-up?
Yes.
One of the things that I've been told, and I don't know how prevalent it is, but I've been told in my district that many of the parties that are held for teenagers, particularly in the junior and senior level of high school, are given by parents who provide the alcohol. Now, do you think that's prevalent in the state of Oregon?
Senator Verger, Senator Morissette, one of the things that we see often in our state when we don't have a consistent way to educate parents about how to help protect their young people from alcohol use and abuse is that we have a lot of adults who may believe that they are well-intentioned in providing alcohol, providing a safe environment in which their young person may drink. And what we find time and time again is that when that happens, we end up sending the wrong message to our young people, that it is simply being in a safe environment, then it is okay for them to use. And the research shows that there is no more influential factor in a young person's decision to drink than the attitude of their parents. And so as we talk about this type of a campaign, it really needs to be twofold. We need to be thinking as much about how we educate the adults and the parents in our state as educating the youth. Because in too many instances, what you're referring to does happen. And part of that is our responsibility to help adults see that by furnishing to young people or providing them environments in which they can drink, number one, it's illegal, and number two, it helps to further perpetuate the problem and the belief among our young people that there are no consequences for early use of alcohol.
And I believe the AG had a number of legislation that dealt with the
with this question, and that's why it would be nice to sort of have a collaborative effort with the AG and with the prevention people, and I know there's a bill over on the House side that is attempting to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it deals with furnishing, and it's not going very far.
Yeah.
Well, we'll take care of that in
Thank
this
you.
Committee.
Good.
seriously, I think that we need to take a look at this particular bill and do some things to it that might move it along, like funds available rather than $6 million.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps to put in a stricter sanction on parents who furnish alcohol mm-hmm. to young people. It's one thing within your own family, but it's another thing to have a party, a safe, quote-unquote environment is,
right.
I think, asking for a huge liability.
I'd be glad to work with
yeah.
you on
well,
that.
Well, and let's talk about that, because mm-hmm. this, you know, we can do some things with this bill that I think could send a message as well.
Thank you.
Great. Mr. Chair, there is other legislation, and I don't know the bill number, that's addressing this issue, too. So I think it would behoove us to make sure that we coordinate and see what bills are out there addressing this, and I just can't remember the number.
Okay. But we can work on that.
Right.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Karen Wheeler and Gina Nickel. Well, we have getting all kinds of good ideas for this bill, so maybe you can add to it.
Good morning, Chair Morissette, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Program Administrator for the Addictions and Mental Health Division at the Department of Human Services. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify today on Senate Bill 858. AMH supports the policy in Senate Bill 858. However, there's a fiscal impact that's not included in the governor's recommended budget. You will have my written testimony, so I'm not going to read the testimony. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Montes Anderson for her leadership, chairing the governor's statewide leadership team for alcohol-free kids. The leadership team completed a 5-year strategy to reduce and combat underage drinking. And two of the recommendations included in their report are also included in Senate Bill 858, public education and community outreach and mobilization. Oregon's youth need us to take action with regard to underage drinking. National rates for underage drinking are going down. Oregon rates are going up. I had the pleasure of growing up in Coos County. About 18 months ago, I had the opportunity to conduct a focus group with 6 high school students from North Bend High School. What they candidly told me was quite alarming and sticks with me today, partly because I was in my hometown area and partly because of what they said. They said that parents were actually pretty clueless about their whereabouts and clueless about what they were doing after school. They said it was very easy to get alcohol in their community. And the next thing was quite alarming to me. I hadn't heard this before. They said that in their perspective, their eighth grade peers, when they were in eighth grade, they had to start drinking to get ready for high school. They needed to start developing tolerance for alcohol so that they could drink in high school. And then they told me that in high school, by the time they hit 11th grade, they needed to start drinking more to prepare for college. I hadn't heard that before. I was quite flabbergasted. We must collectively take action to address underage drinking. This is not something that can be addressed by schools alone, by parents alone, by the community alone, or by state government alone. We need collective action. The Institute of Medicine's report on reducing underage drinking, a collective responsibility, along with the United States Surgeon General's call for action, both recommend the strategies that are included in Senate Bill 858, along with other strategies like state and national leadership, alcohol taxes, implementing effective research-based school and family prevention curricula, which we do have some efforts underway, but not enough, enhancing support for law enforcement and adjudication efforts, and improving data collection and evaluation. A greater proportion of youth from North Bend High School and other schools across the state who engage in underage drinking will end up forming chronic patterns of alcohol abuse, poorly performing in school, engaging in risky sexual behaviors and other risky behaviors. Youth who start drinking before the age of 15, compared to youth who waited until they were 21 years old, were 12 times more likely to be unintentionally injured while under the influence of alcohol, 7 times more likely to be in a motor vehicle crash after drinking, 10 times more likely to have been in a physical fight after drinking. Nationally, 18 to 20-year-olds have the highest prevalence of alcohol dependence of any other age group. In Oregon, 18 to 25-year-olds have the highest prevalence of alcohol and drug abuse than any other age group in Oregon. Consider that roughly $55 million is spent in Oregon alone for alcohol advertising. Youth exposure to alcohol advertising has risen by 38% since 2001. In 2007, 1 in 5 alcohol ads was placed on programming that youth aged 12 to 20 were more likely to see than adults. Underage youth saw 15% more magazine beer ads per capita than adults in 2004. We're sending the wrong message to our youth. We owe it to the youth of Oregon to take swift, bold, and collective action to begin to turn the tide on underage drinking. I thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Senator Montez Anderson.
We haven't addressed the impact on brain activity. Can you let us know if there's any research on alcohol and brain development, and a person's brain is not fully developed, really. I think they said it's the age 25 when you could really say that the brain is fully developed.
Chair Morissette, Senator Montez Anderson, yes. There are studies about brain development and the impact of alcohol on brain development. There's definitely an impact. I can get those studies and cite them to you. We can follow up with that information. I think if we would have known today what we know about brain development and alcohol, we might have reconsidered the underage, the drinking age, to bump it up to 25.
Mm-hmm. This is a very simple bill. There's only 17 lines. Now, if we take out line 13 and line 15, which are the... No. Well, you just mentioned this a minute ago.
Yeah, I agree.
And put in with funds available. So let's get rid of the fiscal right away. Funds available. And I think if you preface this with whereases, like we, as we do in some bills, to state the compelling reasons why we need to do this and start the bill with your whereases, and then we could, I think, make a very strong, strong bill out of this. And I would like to see a recommendation that we do a partnership, if it's not in here, with the schools. Strongly recommend we do a partnership with the various school districts, and then let the partnership work with the schools and the various communities, but use the legislative language to urge strongly, and I think we can pass this bill.
Okay.
And
may I ask a question?
Yes, indeed.
Are you aware of funds from CDC or, well, maybe not CDC, but yeah, SAMHSA, the feds, that could help us so that if we got this at least into statute or at least have something that says that it's okay to get that money?
Chair Morissette, Senator Montez Anderson. Yes, there are several efforts underway. The Center for Substance Abuse Prevention with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration has a grant opportunity that we've actually applied for. It's called the Strategic Prevention Framework Grant, and it totals $2.3 million a year for 5 years. We have an active application currently in for that grant, And some of those efforts that are included in our application would align with the community mobilization efforts that are in the bill. There are also some opportunities.
Now, excuse me, is that a competitive grant? Could you tell us why we have to pay attention to our competitive? You don't have to talk about that now. A competitive grant, though, means that states have to compete, and there are certain conditions, and one of the conditions is that they adopt a prescription drug monitoring program. And if a state doesn't do that, at some point they will be at the bottom of the list of competitive grants. So this is one of those competitive grants that I think we need to pay attention to.
Chair Morissette, you're correct. This is a competitive grant, and I would emphasize the word competitive. This is our third time applying for this grant. We have not yet gotten it. The feds want all the states to have this opportunity. In the past, the states who haven't had the grant have been funded to conduct epidemiological work groups. So we have had that opportunity, and I believe we have analyzed hundreds of data sets. We have more information about not only underage drinking, but illicit drug use and tobacco use than we've ever had before. We know more about the state than we ever have known before.
So strong statutory language would help us get that grant, do you suppose, if we talked about forming partnership with schools and doing educational things and making sure that the OLCC takes action to remove the sports lookalikes from the counter and so on. All of those things could help.
Senator Morissette, anything we can do to help us get this?
The parents that throw parties, beer parties for the neighborhood kids, additional sanctions that are stated in the legislation, so on.
It'd be wonderful.
We're building a great bill.
We are. We are.
It's a work in progress.
Please add your name to it.
Senator Virginia.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the case of gambling addiction, casinos are providing funds for that type of treatment. What participation do the alcohol manufacturers, beer, hard liquor, and so forth, what kind of funds do they put up so that you could sponsor this type of media campaign particularly?
Chair Morissette, Senator Berger, the pipeline for funding that goes to prevention and treatment that's generated by liquor and beer is through the tax and the revenue that goes to local governments and cities. The alcohol industry has put effort somewhat into responsibility campaigns themselves. There is a reluctance upon the prevention community and the treatment community to some extent to actually accept funds from the alcohol industry. It would sort of be like accepting funds from the tobacco industry for the tobacco prevention folks. So it really, I don't believe it's done a whole lot, but the taxes from alcohol definitely pays for some of the prevention and treatment services.
Well, Mr. Chair, we do accept funds from the tobacco and the master settlement, but I would think that it would be good public relations for them, regardless of whether they gave you the money, but if they just simply put out their own awareness of underage, after all, that's illegal. They're not trying to say their product isn't fine if you're legal. So it would seem to me that it would be a good move for them. And I was not thinking necessarily of putting the money through the state at all, but simply having them encouraged to do their own media campaign.
They do, Mr. Chair. They do, but the media is focused on ages 12 to 24, as I forget who stated, to encourage them to drink. So. Yeah.
Well, that's not exactly what I had in mind.
No.
Okay. Gina, thank you very much, Karen.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Morissette, committee members. My name is Dr. Gina Nickel. I am the Executive Director of the Association of Community Mental Health Programs. And I won't take much more of your time, but I really wanted to lend support to the testimony today of Kayleen, Stephanie, and Karen. I also want to thank Senator Morris Anderson for her leadership. I think it's been a long time coming. I just wanted to let you know that from 1988 to 1993, Oregon spent quite a bit more money in prevention, and we saw those drinking ages for eighth grade and 11th grade, those drinking ages really dropped, and we saw a lot of progress when we combined with the schools, did media campaigns, and instituted curricula throughout the schools. Some of that is still done, but not to the degree that it was in the late 1980s. So we would encourage you. Oregon has a lot of research right here in our own backyard, Oregon Research Institute. For those of you that know Dr. Tony Biglin, he has a lot of research. If you don't have it, I'm sure you do, but I will get it to you again. I would just encourage you to do whatever you need to this bill to pass it out and send the strong message that that Oregon needs to do prevention again. Our kids deserve it. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Thank you very much. Thank you. And we'll work on this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Others wishing to testify? Okay, seeing no others, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 858 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 530. A work session. Senator Boquist, would you come up, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senator Boquist. I just want to report back to you, Mr. Chair. I know there were some questions during the public hearing before. I know the department returned some PowerPoint slides and answers to the questions. And then after our discussion, Mr. Chair, I did attend one of the Homeland Security Council meetings, which I'm a member of. Luckily, one of the fallouts from having been a co-chair previously with the good Senator Verger, I'm still on the Homeland Security issue. And one of the lead topics of that meeting, of course, was the pandemic issue, state preparedness, so on and so forth. I did want to report that there are, as a result of that and some of the briefings there are presently federal matching funds that can be utilized by states in filing for grants that cover some of these areas. And the interesting part, like, that we don't see normally in DHS-type funding, it's either 1 to 2 or something, 1.5, 1.7, 2.2, something like that. This is a 20 to 1 match opportunity. So if we put up, we'll say hypothetically, $50,000 and we get a grant between now and the end of the year here, we can match it with another $950,000 potentially. It does change next year and go to a 10 to 1 match, but there's an opportunity here, Mr. Chair, even in these tight budget times, if we got some money out of the Ways and Means Committee where we can go into the federal programs, apply a grant, identify this as matching funds, and actually make some substantial progress. I'd close and then get out of here, Mr. Chair, by saying that the Homeland Security Council presently is comprised the cities, counties, local governments, fire departments. There's about 25 or 30 members that attend regularly. And this particular issue, I'll just say, raised eyebrows in the last meeting, especially with the cities and counties and the actual level of preparation we're at. The state's doing a good job. They have several coordinators working on it. But having said we're doing a good job, we're still at about the bottom rung of the other 50 states. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay. So the 20 to 1 matching is good until the end of this biennium, the calendar year, fiscal year?
Mr. Chair, I believe it's through the fiscal year, the federal fiscal year, and then it takes over to a 10 to 1 matching fund, I believe, after that. And, of course, we have to apply for the grant, but as you well know, we have to have first a pot of something, whether it's $5,000 or $10,000 or something to go there.
That's great, great, good. Good work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Others wishing to testify? Okay. Seeing no one, we will, we do have a quorum.
We have the fiscal, Mr. Chair.
We do have the fiscal. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, we'll send it on. We need a motion.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move.
Senator Sanderson.
that we pass Senate Bill 530 with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson moves that we pass Senate Bill 530 with a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We do have the fiscal, and we can send it down there. Discussion? Objections? Seeing none? So moved.
Mr. Chair?
Excused.
Yeah. Yeah, Senator Telfer is excused. Okay. Others wishing to testify about anything at all? The weather, maybe? No? Okay. We will adjourn.
No. We have...
We can do that?
340. We have
dash
one fiscal reopen.
I don't have it here.
Yeah. Let's reopen, Senator.
wait. Oh, okay.
You didn't bring
the sheet that I had was an old one. It's been revised. We keep changing the agendas here, so how are we supposed to keep track? We'll open our session, and we will hear Senate Bill 340.
Are we in work session, Mr. Chair?
We are in work session on Senate Bill 340.
Okay. We have already adopted the Dash 1 amendment, so
yes,
at
indeed.
This point...
This is my bill. Why did I not...
I don't know why you didn't... Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 340 as amended with the Dash 1 amendment to the floor with the due pass recommendation and subsequent referral of the Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay. Senator Cruz means move Senate Bill 340 to the floor of the Senate with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
With the due pass recommendation.
With the due pass recommendations. Okay. Discussion? Okay, seeing no discussion. Would the clerk call the roll on this one, please?
Senator Monis Anderson.
Aye.
Senator Irvin.
Aye.
Senator Telfer.
Excused.
Vice Chair Cruz.
Aye.
Chair Morrison.
Aye. Okay, Senate Bill 340 will move to Ways and Means. Okay, we're going to carry... Wait, are we going to... Yeah, okay. So Senate Bill 355 will be carried over until Wednesday. Okay. Other work before the committee. Okay. Again, we are adjourned. One more time.
And for real this time.
And for